Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for real estate investors looking to protect their assets, save on taxes, and build their wealth with Clint Coons. Clint is an attorney, author, avid real estate investor, and featured instructor at Anderson's tax and asset protection events held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone. Hi, it's Clint Coons here with Anderson Business Advisors, and this is another episode of our podcast. You know, when I started going into this podcast, I was thinking about a topic that is relevant, that is on everyone's mind right now, or a lot of people's mind who invest in real estate. And this matter came up when I was dealing with a client that has to do with putting together an operating agreement where they are going to go out and buy an apartment complex, and they're going to bring in investors, right? You've all heard about that. Everybody talks about the potential there, but let's face it, with what's going on right now in our society in the United States, I think most real estate investors can agree that there are going to be some opportunities out there, that if you're a serious real estate investor, you can see the signs, and you have to be positioning yourself to make sure that when those opportunities present themselves, you're ready to take action. And many times that means putting together the right operating agreements, the right documents, corporations, LLCs. Let's say if you're buying single family homes, you know, you've heard me talk about land trust before, limited liability companies. But if you're going to go bigger, and I think a lot of people want to get that economies of scale, you can make more cash. Now you're going to move into a different realm. When you go big and you start working with other people, it's no longer, hey, you make a mistake, you just lose the asset. Now you make a mistake, they cannot possibly throw an orange jumpsuit on you, and you get to live in the big house for a while. So we don't want to see that happen to you. And that's why on this episode, what we're going to do is bring on a good friend of mine, Dugan Kelly of Kelly Clark PC, who is a securities attorney. They do the whole gamut. They help people set up the right docs. They handle the transactional side as well of putting these together. And he has over 20 years of experience. You know, when I first ran into him, it was through an introduction from other individuals in this space that are buying properties and syndicating. They said, this is the expert, Clint. You got to meet this guy. He knows what he's doing. So I thought, perfect, let's bring him on. So with that, Dugan, how you doing?
I'm good, Clint. Glad to be here.
That's great. Now, just so everyone knows, you're down in Texas, right? You're right outside of Dallas.
Yeah, we have brick and mortar offices in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We're in what we call the North Texas Corridor. We're up here on the edge of Frisco, Texas, where the new Cowboys practice facility is built by Jerry Jones out here. And then our other location is in Santa Barbara, California.
Yeah, Santa Barbara is a beautiful area. I mean, if I had a ton of money, I wouldn't mind having a second home there.
It is definitely beautiful. It's like an adult Disneyland for people, for properties and everything.
Yeah. And there's great wine. The Pinot's up there. They're phenomenal.
For sure.
Yeah. So when it comes to this type of investing, you have a tremendous amount of expertise. You work with real estate investors all over the country. And, you know, what I'd like to start off is just kind of laying the groundwork for people, because it happens so much in what I do that an individual will call me up and they'll say, listen, I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy this piece of property, but I'm going to bring in a few friends and we're going to joint venture on it. And there's this gray area. You know, people are always wondering, when does it go beyond just a little partnership amongst friends and it becomes something more that you have to use someone like you? What would you say to that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I get asked it a lot, as I know that you do, from people throughout the country that are looking to invest in real estate or are looking to essentially figure out how to buy an apartment building or something more than just with their own money. So the rule of thumb is that any time that you're taking money from someone and they are expecting a return on that money, in other words, they're not going to share in the downside or necessarily have any obligations in the entity itself that owns and operates the asset, and your purpose is essentially to raise capital, meaning if you're asking somebody for money, they're expecting a return on that investment and you're raising capital. That is a security. There's no, unfortunately, there's no friends and family exemption. There's no, you know, I got money from my dad or my mom, and so therefore it's not a security. It doesn't matter if you call it a joint venture or anything else, that is a security. So that is different than if you and two of your buddies went and said, hey, I found a dry cleaners we want to buy, and the purchase price is $200,000, and each of us are going to contribute equal share to buy that dry cleaners business, and that's treated as a capital contribution, which is different. That's a true joint venture, small enough so that you and your buddies can use your own money, and you're going to have an active role in the entity in managing that business. Then you can kind of avoid this whole issue of securities. But if the person that you're taking the money from in order to buy the asset is expecting a return of that capital, that is a security, and you really need to raise that money, that equity, in order to acquire that asset through what we call a private placement memorandum procedure.
I've always looked at it that way when I meet real estate investors that, you know, want to do this, and they're just going to work with maybe four or five guys that they know. I always say, well, listen, you got to make sure that everyone's a manager. Is that what I'm hearing from you? The way to get out of this context, if there's just a few people coming together, just give everyone, make them a manager in the LLC and be done with it?
Yeah. So, I mean, through it simplistically, yes, but It can't simply be camouflage, right? So if it smells like a security, if it looks like one, and if somebody reading the operating agreement of the LLC couldn't tell what each of the parties that own the members of that LLC or the managers are actually going to be doing, and in practice, if they're not really doing anything, then I would say, you know, you're running the risk potentially of engaging in securities without any of the protections afforded to you that you get through that private placement procedure. But in general, yeah, if there's two or three friends and each of them want to put their money in and essentially buy their equity through capital contributions, and they're not expecting any particular rate of return, they're just going to share in the profits through distributions. Yeah, there's no reason that they need to go through the process of syndication or the process of getting selling those interests to private investors.
But they still have to manage, though, right? Is that correct?
They still have to manage. They still have to have control. They still have to have a role other than, here's my money. You know, it really has to pass that smell test.
Yeah, and everyone's, you know, real estate investors sometimes can be cheap when it comes to the legal side, because LegalZoom and, you know, all these other internet places make it seem like, oh, you just, you know, throw this together and you're good to go. You're protected. But I mean, in this area, more so than anything else, if you screw this up, I mean, what are the penalties? What could they be?
It's really short-sighted for people, as I'm sure that you see in your business, short-sighted for people to take shortcuts. There's all these things, law in a box, that you see pop up on the internet, the next greatest, you know, template that people want to use or whatever. The reality is that you do so at your own peril. And the peril can be significant. It could be massive. You could have fines levied against you by the Securities and Exchange Commission or other regulatory bodies, the state securities board in which you're operating. You could be precluded doing any other private offerings for the balance of your life. Your name could go essentially on a watch list or a no-fly list, supposedly, on not being able to do business and raise capital. And then worst case scenario, if you're habitually about this or you're intentional or depending on what the actions are that you do, you theoretically could face criminal penalties. So it's not, securities is not something that you want to mess around with. It's not something that I would ever advise my family, my friends, my wife, my sisters, even my children, when they get older, to do by simply doing some sort of template that they purchase over the internet. You really want to have a trusted team member come alongside of you that you can work with to make sure that your offering is compliant and that in the event that there are changes needed, that you can do that. And so you've kind of hit the nail on the head, Clint. It's really not a situation where you want to mess around and kind of like chance that you're going to be able to get through this without any problems on the backside, because the problems are so massive, you never want to risk it.
Yeah, because any real estate investor has experienced at some point in time, experienced investor that is, that, you know, an investment goes down and you could potentially lose money on it. But the problem that I try to explain to people is that in this context, when you're working with third parties, you think, well, I'm just working with Joe. No. You're working with Joe, yes, but you're also working with his wife. And if you lose money on this deal, and that was the college fund that they'd set aside for their son that he thought he was going to invest with you and double his money, and you lose it, that wife's going to be out for bear. And in that situation, people think, well, the entity will protect me. No, this is a situation where the attorney's going to come and he's going to sue your assets off because right. The entity is not going to protect you, right?
You're right. And those provisions in the operating agreement that may have defense or indemnity obligations, well, what happens if the entity itself has no assets, right? And what if they claim alter ego liability, or they try to get to your personal assets involved in the entity? So it's really not something that you can mess around with. Remember, the purpose of the private placement memorandum, in large part, one of the huge factors is for your protection. It's for both. It's for both to inform the investors of the potential risks associated with investing in this particular commercial real estate asset, but it's also equally important for the sponsor or the syndicator, the person bringing that deal to the private market, to protect them and their assets and their family. And so you don't really want to take shortcuts. It's so short-sighted when people take shortcuts in connection with a securities offering.
Okay. So then, you know, one of the things that I often tell people is you should get an entity set up before you go out and make your offer. So you have that entity available. So if it's possible, you could take title in the name of the entity, make the offer in the name of the entity, you do that. Well, from a security standpoint, if I was considering moving to that next level now, because I see there's opportunities here, and I want to ask you a little bit about that as well in a moment, but if I see that coming down in the next month and a half, and I want to start doing these types of deals, when should I start exploring setting up something like this type of structure? After I get the property under contract, or is it beforehand?
So I'm a big believer, Clint, just like you are, in that if you're going to be in the real estate space and you're going to be buying and selling real property, you need to do it not through your individual name. You need to be doing that through your own entity. So ideally, in a perfect world, you have your own entity that's already set up that is sending out those letters of intent. So those commercial real estate brokers that you're developing relationships with, you are firing out LOIs under your entity's name. Now, when you have an LOI that's accepted and you enter into that purchase and sale agreement, the key is really your entity or its assigns. So remember, the entity that ultimately will be the borrower that you will raise capital out of, that will ultimately be the owner of the asset and that you will sell off to passive investors, is an entity that is created after, typically, after you get a property under contract. And your entity assigns, meaning it transfers ownership of the purchase and sale agreement to that entity. That is the most common way in which these deals are structured, but it's never really advisable for somebody in their individual name to go out and put a property under contract and then start to create entities, because you already have that contingent kind of liability that exists, right? Because you've already put something under contract in your own name, and now you're trying to paper it up on the backside. Whereas on the front side, what we want you to do is put the property under contract in your own entity, the entity that you own and control. And then after you've kicked the tires on the wheel and you decide that you're really going to go for it, right? That's the point that you would engage a securities attorney. So if you know that you're not going to, you know, you get into due diligence, and you see that the property has foundation problems or whatever it is, the service contracts are too expensive, or there's exceptions on the title policy that are prohibitive for that to meet your business plan or your pro forma for potential investors, then you would not want to incur the costs or fees associated with hiring a securities attorney before that. It doesn't make any sense. You'd be basically wasting money. So you want to be able to know that you have enough due diligence to know that you are going to go for it. You're going to try to acquire this and you're going to raise equity. So before you start raising equity, before you start taking money from investors, you need to have your entity that you're going to syndicate up needs to be live, and your offering needs to go live. So I tell clients, do not take somebody's money. Do not take their money into your entity or into your own bank account, unless you're doing it through the entity that is ready to be syndicated, unless your offering is live and all of your documents are in order.
There's a couple things there that I want to go a little deeper on. So if I set up my, I have an entity, just an LLC set up. And what you said was make the offer. And I talk about this all the time. You know, I say and or designated entity, or you said and or assigns. Yes. In a commercial context, that's fine because they expect this to happen on a commercial property that you will typically assign it over to that ultimate closing entity that you're going to take title in. But how long does it take? I mean, if I have this property, I get past my due diligence, my money's gone hard, and let's say I have a 60-day closing set up after that, how do I thread the needle and get this entity set up to PPM, the LLC that's going to hold the title, my lending, and bring all that together? Is that enough time, or what should I tell the people?
Most syndications or private placement offerings throughout the United States, the typical raise period on a commercial asset is anywhere between 30, 45 days, 60 days to be a lengthy raise. So I typically tell clients, listen, you've gotten a property under contract, and it's not like you're calling up your attorney cold and saying, I need all this in 24 hours. Typically, the turnaround you should expect somewhere in the neighborhood of a week, right? From the moment that you tell your attorney, your securities attorney, go get me a draft. I want to go live. I want to start raising capital. That process typically should be a week, maybe sooner, so that you maximize the time that you have in order to raise. And I have lots of clients that they know going into it. Like if their LOI is accepted, they're off to the races because they know they're going to go for it. They know they're going to acquire the property. And so they're not going to wait. But for most new operators or people that would like to scale up, get a larger acquisition and use other people's money to do that, they need to get through some portion of due diligence in order to really determine, is this property something that you could raise capital on? At that moment, when you decide that, whenever that is for you, is the moment that you should call a securities attorney and say, what information do you need from me, Mr. Securities Attorney, in order to set up the entity that I'm going to syndicate or that's going to ultimately own this? How do we transfer this from my entity that has this under contract to that entity? And how do I get my hands on those documents, the private placement memorandum, in order to start raising capital? That's it's not a one size fits all for clients. It's really what is your situation? What does the deal look like? And are you really prepared to go for it?
Let's say I haven't found the property yet. Can I start having conversations with people that, you know, my friends are at a RIA meeting? Hey, you know, I'm looking to do one of these deals. Who might be interested in coming in if I find something like this? Is that acceptable or not?
It's very common for people to speak with people that they know, like, and trust. Mm-hmm. Most of the syndications that take place are what we call private placement offerings under Reg D, and there are the two big exemptions from public registration of your private offering are either a 506B offering or a 506C offering. Most people in the United States are still doing 506B offerings. And what that is that means that it's everyone that you have a pre-existing substantive relationship with. So it is not uncommon for people to tell people, hey, I just started an entity. I have a property under contract. I'm thinking about raising capital. I know that, we've been friends for a long time. I know that you're interested in investing in real estate. If I were to think about raising capital on this thing, would you be interested? Those types of conversations, that's fine. But I would not blast out, because these are securities. You cannot publicly solicit to invest in your deal unless you're going to do what we call a 506C offering. But the downside for people that do 506C offerings are you're restricted to accredited investors only. So if you want to blast your offering out via social media, right? Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, put it on a billboard, put it on a radio, whatever you want to do, as long as it's not fraudulent, it's accurate, transparent, authentic. If you intend to do that, then you're restricting yourself to accredited investors only. So think about that, though. If the vast majority of investors in the United States and people in general are not accredited investors, that means that the likelihood of your Rolodex and anyone else that is your partner on that deal, their Rolodex is filled with people that are likely not accredited investors. An accredited investor is someone most typically whose net worth is something north of $1 million, backing out the value of their primary residence, or they've made $200,000 in the past 2 years, or $300,000 with their spouse's income, and with the reasonable expectation of making that same amount in the future. That is a set criteria. It's not a fuzzy slide rule that you can move up and down. It's set. So if your Rolodex is not filled with those types of individuals, then I would tell you, you do not want to engage in pushing things out on social media to people. It is not an improper solicitation to talk to people that you know, like, and trust, that people that you have a pre-existing substantive relationship with. And so think about this. The vast majority of people that invest in real estate, they invest with people they know, like, and trust. You're not investing in large part on seeing some offering on a bus bench, right? Or listening to it in the radio, or seeing it in the sky by some plane that wrote something. That's not how people invest. They're not investing. The conversion of stranger investor to actual investor, in large part in the United States, does not take place through advertisements. So unless you have a large social media following, like a Grant Cardone or somebody like that, your eyeballs are always on you day in, day out, and you can push something out with a tweet or something and you've got tons of action. The reality is most people, even seasoned syndicators, I'm talking about people that are doing, you know, massive deals, they're still doing 506B offerings, which means they're not advertising. They know that they're not going to convert stranger investor to potential investor. And they're only engaging in raising capital inside of the people that they actually have that pre-existing substantive relationship with.
So what I'm hearing then is it's okay to talk to people, but you can't get any money from them until you have all the documents in place to cover your ass.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
So, you know, if I was going to be an operator here and I was going to put this together, then if I wanted to manage the investment, since I'm going to be the one buying, finding the property, can I have a separate entity manage it? Or does it have to be everything run through the syndication that we're creating, that LLC, to own it?
That's a great question. In fact, most common structures of a syndication, the sponsor or syndicator forms their own entity to manage that entity that owns the asset. So in other words, it's not advisable for you to be an individual manager. So even though the operating agreement says that you as individual manager are not responsible for the debts and obligations of the entity, the reality is, what Clint and I've already talked about, anybody can be sued for anything, right? This is America. God bless us. But the reality is, you don't want to be individually managing the entity that is syndicated. You want to operate, if you're going to be the manager, so oftentimes the sponsor, the person that finds the deal, that gets it under contract as well, right? Makes sense. You're going to stay with the asset through the life cycle. You're the one that's raising the capital. You're the one that's forming the entity that's going to be sold off to investors, that's ultimately going to be the borrower, that signs the loan docs, that gets the loan proceeds in order to acquire the keys to the asset. Well, that person is not doing that in through their individual capacity. They're often doing it through a separate entity, and that is the manager of the LLC. So the most common structure that you're going to see for syndicated commercial real estate assets around the country are manager-managed limited liability companies. And the limited liability company that will own the apartment building, that is a manager-managed LLC. And what do you think the manager is? The manager is another entity. And that other entity is often an entity that is owned and controlled by the sponsor or the syndicator. And so all of that stuff has to be set up. And remember, these are best practices. So I see people do things that are crazy all the time, but they've often decided that they know they are going to just risk it, right? And so many people that ask for help at the 11th hour, unfortunately, they die at 10:30. And the reality is you're going to get sued at 10:30, and at the 11th hour, you're going to ask for help. And often it's too late to help. Or at that point, we're just bringing our dumpster along and sweeping as much of it into it as possible. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that your entities are up, that you're protected, that you understand the structure, because you're going to be essentially raising capital from people that you have this pre-existing relationship with, that you're going to be able to explain it to them. So you want to be able to do all of that in a timely manner, because remember, like Clint said, you're going to have a very short time frame within which to do all this stuff, right? You get a property under contract, and the likelihood is the seller is going to have an expectation that you close within 60 days or sooner. And while you're dealing with the seller, the lender is pressing on you for items, right? Because you're raising debt. Most people are syndicating equity, meaning they're raising the capital necessary for the down payment in order to get that loan to buy the apartment building or the commercial real estate asset. So you're doing all of these things. It's often confusing. It can seem overwhelming. That's why you want to have a good team around you to make sure that your structure is sound and that you're compliant at all times.
Just yesterday, one of my clients sent me over the syndication that he's going to be investing in. And the attorney that put together the operating agreement, I don't know if this is his specialty. I mean, I don't think it is, because I'm reading through it. It's member managed. So as you just described, you know, they're always manager managed typically. Well, his is member managed. And they said, well, the managing member. And I thought, well, if they're all members, how are you going to assign out one managing member? Because they referenced the statute, and the statute said if it's member managed, then all the members have authority over the entity. And so they're trying to do this weird hybrid structure. And I was going through it, and I was just kidding, you know, we got issues here, we got issues here. It doesn't address this. If you're going to refinance a property, and it becomes, if you know what to look for, you can spot these issues. So if I'm an investor like my client is, you know, and they don't have access to someone like myself or you, and they're listening on this podcast right now, what are some of the red flags? If, you know, let's take the other side now. If somebody wants you to invest in their syndication and you get these documents, what should I be looking at and saying, all right, this doesn't pass the smell test? Because I'm sure you've seen it.
Oh, yeah. So we vet deals, as you do, for investors, for passive investors throughout the United States. And we often get offering docs, or investor likes the deal, right? They like the asset, but they don't know what to look for. And many of these private placement memorandums are a couple hundred pages long, maybe even longer. So there's a couple key things that you always want to look for. One is, what am I buying, right? What am I buying, and is it in the market in which I expect? Meaning, you would think it's basic common sense, but if you don't look at the details, often you can miss it. So what am I buying? And then two, what are my rights and obligations? Meaning, I know you want my money, but at what point do I get my money back? Do I get my money back? And is there a preferred return? And what is that waterfall? So you might hear the word waterfall or plan of distribution. Who gets paid what and when? Those are key things that are going to be set forth in both the offering, meaning your PPM, as well as the operating agreement or the limited partnership agreement. Remember, once an offering closes or the acquisition of the property actually consummated, the PPM really throws it, I mean, it gets thrown in the trash in many cases, because the only governing document that exists between passive investors and the sponsors or the managers of these things is the operating agreement. So Clint's absolutely right. You're looking at the operating agreement to see who gets paid what and when and how long. Like, what's the exit strategy? I don't know too many of my investor clients that are going to want to give you capital so that you can buy an asset and that they never get a return on a timely basis. So what's the exit strategy? All of this needs to be laid out in the operating agreement. And if it's not there, it's a major red flag. We're in a time right now where there's a lot of fear, unrealistic fear in the commercial real estate space. I've got passive investors calling me saying, what happens if there's a cash call? And what are my obligations? Do I have to give them more money, even if I don't want to give them more money? What happens if I don't give them more money? All of those things, if they're not set forth in the operating agreement, that's kind of a red flag. And so just this deal that you just got presented with, that somebody says they're a member-managed LLC, my first question would be like, that's not going to get through underwriting, meaning the lender's not even going to allow that. The lender likely is not going to loan millions of dollars, depending on the size of the acquisition, to an entity that is member-managed, because the lender doesn't want to deal with 50 passive investors or 50 members or 100 members or 150 members. Remember, the lender is going to want to have a uniform one voice. That's why the lender and people that are seasoned commercial real estate professionals on the legal side are setting these entities up in large part to be manager managed, so that the lender can actually yell at one person or two people or their entities. They don't want to talk to all of the members that have given you capital. They want to know who they are and how much capital they have in the deal. But remember, the lender has the most at risk, because you're using the bank's money. Depending on your leverage, meaning the amount you're able to borrow, the bank could have 80% skin in the game, and your passive investors may have 20% skin in the game. So who do you think has the bigger stick in that scenario? It's the lender, not even the investor. So if I see those things, those are red flags. And it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult for an investor, or even somebody as seasoned as Clint, for Clint to go back to the attorney that has prepared those documents and demand changes. Why? Because those documents have been shotgunned out to hundreds, if not more, people, right? All the people in the Rolodex of the sponsors. And for them to begin to make changes, it has a ripple effect. So you want to make sure that your documents, your entities, are set up correctly ahead of time and up, because the chances of you as a passive investor, one investor, being able to dictate changes in the syndication or the offering docs are very low, very, very low.
Yeah, that's what I tell people. I said, listen, if you see the docs, and these docs that I was looking at, they're more deficient than that. They had they didn't even address the sale of the property, the refinancing, except there was one clause that stated if the property is refinanced, then the company can redeem all the members' interest for a dollar.
And I said, oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was just shocked. And my client, you know, he said, well, could send me some language maybe that should be in there. And I said, well, why do you even want to go forward with this? Because the sponsor that you're dealing with, it tells me that they haven't invested themselves into what they're doing, because they're trying to go on the cheap. And if they're trying to go on the cheap here, they're going to go on the cheap other places. And this is just going to be a snowball effect. But you know, it takes people to go through.
And they may have had the best of intention, right?
Yeah.
They may have had the best of intention, but the credibility, right? Their loss of credibility with you immediately when you looked at that impacted that potential investor. And that potential investor is going to share that with other potential investors. And the reality is that sponsor's credibility didn't need to take a hit. Didn't need to take a hit if they would have had a more professional understanding of the whole process.
All right. So on a different tack then, you know, with what's going on right now, what do you think commercial, when I say commercial, typical commercial property versus multifamily, what do you see with your clients? Where are they looking to make the moves in the next, you know, 2 to 3 quarters or up to a year? Where do they see that investment play going?
We talk about with clients all the time, and it depends on if you're the sponsor or the manager. You're looking at, what's my cash reserves look like? What are my tenants looking like? What does my economic vacancy look like? Meaning, I know my properties have tenants in them. Are those tenants actually paying their rent? When tenants don't pay their rent, your economic vacancy, meaning the money that you're expecting is not there, that goes up. That increases pressure on you. And many of these loan agreements with lenders will have covenants as to what happens on the property. I lived through and was practicing in 2007, 2008. So 20 years of practice tells me that when there's crisis in the marketplace, the capital markets start to be sluggish and it's hard to find leverage, you get unscrupulous lenders out there. They may be hard money. They may be somebody that you thought would never call the recourse events in connection with that. or you've signed a personal guarantee on a commercial real estate asset. You never have thought that your personal guarantee is actually going to come into effect. In times of crisis, those events often play themselves out in very, very bad ways. So I've seen equity theft, meaning lenders' ability to declare what they perceive to be a default, even if it's a non-monetary default, in connection with the loan agreement, to try to foreclose on an asset that has hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in equity in it through a credit bidding process. So you want to be aware, if you're a sponsor or manager of these entities that own commercial real estate assets, you want to be aware of what are your obligations under the loan agreement, right? You sign this in good times. You sign this with the best of intentions, and you never thought that there would be a crunch or a downward turn in the economy. So now, whether it's realistic fear or not, there is fear theoretically in the marketplace. And so the question is, what do you do and how do you guard against theoretically losing the one thing that you cannot lose? And that is the asset. Because remember, as the sponsor, the manager, you have fiduciary obligations of care and loyalty to your passive investors. And the number one rule is don't let the asset go. So don't get foreclosed upon. So understanding your loan agreements, your operating agreements, we walk clients through that from the sponsor side to make sure that they know what their obligations are to the passive investors, that they have an understanding of their cash reserves, that they can meet their debt obligations. And if they think that they cannot, then we try to grab the bull by the horns and engage with the lender immediately in order to get some sort of forbearance agreement put into place. Forbearance simply means that we want the lender to push pause on its expectation of receiving rent or mortgage payments from us as the borrower, which in turn helps us manage expectations by the passive investors, right? Because then we don't have the risk associated with the asset theoretically being foreclosed upon. So while we might not have the cash available to pay distributions to our investors, because our tenants at our properties, well, it doesn't matter what the commercial data asset is, could be multifamily, could be commercial strip mall, could be a bowling alley. If those places have tenants that are paying us rent, and for whatever reason they stop paying rent, they're in default to us, yes, but that doesn't help us in connection with our relationship with our lender. It's not an excuse for you to go to your lender and say, I didn't make my monthly mortgage payment because the tenants didn't make their rent payment to me. You need to have a very solid understanding of those triggers that happen in those pinch points and seize the opportunity to engage with your lender for a different deal, for another deal if you need to. You got to do that early on. Don't wait. Remember, people that plead for mercy at the 11th hour often die at 10:30. So don't wait.
So as far as investing then, if you're looking to get into some properties now, what would you suggest? Commercial, multifamily, or just hold off for a while?
I still am a big believer, Clint, in the multifamily market. And the reason why is a couple of reasons. One, in large part, the lenders that are lending, both at the agency level, meaning Freddie, Fannie, or HUD, these are federally backed lenders, those, and even at the bridge space, meaning private lenders, that debt that you're borrowing is largely non-recourse, okay? That means the lenders are not stupid, right? So they know that it is non-recourse debt, in my opinion, is always better than recourse debt. So investors that are looking to take cash that's just sitting in a bank account, it's not earning anything, it's not moving, it's not generating any opportunities, I'm going to be looking for opportunities in the multi-space to either invest or sponsor those deals and bring those and raise the capital necessary on this side of it. So I'm seeing sellers, seasoned sellers in that space, be more realistic on pricing. And I'm seeing longer closing periods so that sellers know that in order to get a property through market, the raising of capital and raising of debt and get through due diligence, that's taking longer than average, right? Because of what's going on currently throughout the country. And so when you have parties that want to get deals done, there will get deals done, but it's going to take kind of wisdom, right? Wisdom on the both sides of the transaction, both the seller as well as the buyer. And if you're in the investor, it's always better to have your money generating more money sitting in a bank account generating very little money. So I'm a big believer, and I'm optimistic that in the next few months, that the sluggishness that we see in the capital markets on the lending of debt is going to loosen up. So there are still deals happening and there are still deals closing. And people that are actively looking for deals right now are seasoned investors. So seasoned investors that have lived through several, you know, points in time like this know that now is the time to hunt. Now's the time to actually be looking, because there's a lot of deal flow and there's a lot of assets potentially up on the block to look at to potentially acquire. So if you're an investor and you're thinking about investing, multifamily, I think, is one of the safest investments because it's diversified. It's non-recourse debt. And in large part, you've got all these little points, the tenants, those are all little contracts that are tied to those tenants. That's diversified streams of income versus a commercial space where I'm relying on an anchor tenant. So if I've got a commercial space and I've got one anchor tenant in there, that goes belly up, right? Because it's reliance upon customers to come into their store. And for whatever reason, it could be a gym, it could be a business that's not essential, that the state or the city in which you live is declared non-essential. And as a result, they can't maximize their business plan or carry it out. That impacts everything. And the reality is, think about this. We all have to live somewhere, but we don't all have to work somewhere. Yep. So if you're an investor and you're thinking about investing, my thing is think about somewhere where people live, and they have to live, because we all have to live somewhere, but we don't all have to work somewhere. So the places that we work at or the places that we patronize, those are the first places in large part that have cash crunch, that are going to go upside down and are going to be in trouble. So if I'm an investor, multifamily, in my belief, is one of the safest places to put your money.
Yep, I would agree. Well, you know, this has been, I think, very interesting, especially on my side, getting this information out of you. And I want to thank you for taking the time to come on and share all of this. You gave me a document that we're going to make available for download. It's going to be in the podcast notes, and it's about the crisis, you know, with COVID and how it affects multifamily or syndications in general, and things that people should be aware of in the operating agreement. So I want to say thanks for that, because I know this is going to help out a lot of people that are considering getting involved in these types of investments. Because just as you stated, there's going to be a lot of opportunity on the horizon here. And either you're a syndicator or you're just going to be an investor in it. You got to go in with eyes wide open. You have to be using professionals that know what to look for, so you don't find out at the back end that you have this huge cash call and you don't have any cash to do it. Then you get diluted out and you lost your money. So I want to thank you for that. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do it?
Yeah, so we're real easy. I make it easy to get a hold of me. You can find me on the web. You can find us on Instagram at Kelly Clark Law. You can find us on Facebook at Kelly Clark PC. We've got a YouTube channel up, or you can just, my email is Dugan, D-U-G-A-N, at Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, Clark, C-L-A-R-K-E.com. Be happy to chat with any of you.
Perfect. Hey, who's the Clark?
The Clark is my partner. He's one of my partners here in the firm.
Is he in California?
It takes a village, Clint. So yeah. No, he splits time between our office in Texas and California. But he's a California boy, born and raised in Santa Barbara.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for coming on, and we'll be in touch shortly.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.